keep them from reinforcing the other flank. That was another part of Belisarius's tactics which hadn't worked as well as he had planned. Judging from what he could see, Belisarius thought Demotara had steadily drawn troops from his left in order to reinforce Sanga's hammer blows on the right. The Malwa lord had judged Belisarius's Syrians correctly. They would be fearsome opponents, defending a steep slope against cavalry, but almost useless in a sally. So he had moved thousands of his Rajput cavalrymen from one end of the battlefield to the other. Belisarius could see large contingents of them cantering across the small valley below the pass, going to reinforce Sanga. And even as he watched, another unit of 500 Rajputs broke away from their lines on his right and did the same. Belisarius almost laughed then. He had never seen a better illustration of Morris's conviction that battles are by nature an unholy, contradictory mess in which nothing ever works the way it's supposed to. This time, however, and thank God for that, it was his enemy who had fallen into the quagmire. Ironically, Demotara's best move was also his worst. If Belisarius had been planning to make a stand, Demotara's transfer of forces would have been a masterstroke. But the Roman general had no intention of doing so. Instead, he was going to pivot his army in a retreat to the southwest, using his right flank as the hinge. His biggest fear had been that Demotara would break the hinge. But now, having depleted his left wing, Demotara hadn't a chance of storming the Syrians on the southern slope of the pass. Buzis and Kutsis would be able to withdraw their men in an orderly manner after covering the retreat of the rest of the army. Marvelous. Marvelous. Assuming, of course, that Belisarius could blunt Sanga's coming charge with his Thracians. And that... He eyed the huge mass of Rajput cavalry on the northern slope. That's going to be... This is going to be fucking dicey, growled Morris. Belisarius turned in his saddle. Unnoticed, Morris had already brought his horse alongside. It's still a mountain pass, broad and shallow as it is, Morris, pointed out Belisarius. It's not a level plain. Sanga won't be able to send more than 5,000 at a time, 6 at the most. Peering between the cheek plates of his helmet, Morris's eyes didn't seem filled with great cheer at this news. He could count just as well as Belisarius. The Thracians were still facing 2-1 odds against an enemy with plenty of reserves. If we didn't have stirrups, said the Kiliarch bleakly, this would be pure suicide. He frowned. Now that I think about it, why don't the Malwa have stirrups? You'd think they would by now. Morris glanced at Belisarius's chest plate, below which aid nestled in a leather pouch. They've got their own visions of the future, don't they? Belisarius shrugged. Link's mind doesn't work like aid's. Aid is an aid. Link is the supreme commander of the universe. I suspect the thing is so bound up with its great plans for future weapons that it didn't think to build on the little possibilities which are already here. It certainly wouldn't have thought to consult with its human tools, any more than you'd ask a hammer's opinion if you were wielding it properly. Not likely, remarked Aid. For Link, people barely even qualify as tools, just so much raw material. Belisarius began to add something, but broke off. He could see the Greeks were ready to mount, and all of his Thracians were here and in formation. May as well do it, said Morris, anticipating his general's thought. Belisarius nodded. A moment later, Morris passed on the command. The Cornisons began to wail. The Greeks surged out of the trenches and began clambering aboard their horses. They were tired, tired. But they found the strength regardless. They were getting out of here and only had to make it down to the river below. The Thracians began moving forward toward the Rajputs. They were slowed a bit, making their way through the narrow spaces between the fieldworks which had been left open for sallies. By the time the Bucellarii made it onto the open and relatively flat northern part of the saddle, Sanga had realized the truth. His own horns began blowing. The sound was different, in pitch and timbre, from that made by Roman cornisons, but Belisarius didn't mistake their meaning. Attack! Now! Everyone! A huge mass of Rajput cavalry surged toward them. Belisarius ordered his own charge. There was no room here for the usual Roman tactic of preceding a lance charge with a murderous volley of arrows. No room and no time. The Thracians were so badly outnumbered that Belisarius could only try to use their greater weight in a single blow of the hammer. The saddle was wide and shallow for a mountain pass, but it was still not a level plain. If his cataphracts with their heavier armor and lances and stirrups could smash the front ranks of the Rajputs into a pulp, that would stymie the rest. Long enough, hopefully, for the Thracians to be able to beat their own retreat. The distance between the two armies vanished in seconds. The hammer fell. The Rajputs did not break. Quite. Belisarius had shattered a Malwa army once before with such a charge on the first day of the battle at Anatha. But that Malwa army had been arrogant and unfamiliar with Roman heavy cavalry tactics. For the Rajputs, too, this was their first time facing Roman cataphracts in a lance charge. But this Malwa army had fought its way across the entire Persian plateau against Aryan Dagans. They had faced heavy cavalry before and won. Every time. Still, the Persians hadn't been equipped with stirrups, and that was the deciding difference. A long, heavy lance braced by feet and stirrups is simply a far more effective weapon than the shorter, much lighter spear used by cavalrymen without stirrups. In the relatively narrow confines of the saddle pass, the Rajputs couldn't avoid those lances, and the lances ripped them apart. But not completely. Not enough to allow the Romans to simply turn and break away. Hundreds of Rajputs in the front ranks survived the first clash and were immediately tying up the cataphracts with their swordplay. Within seconds, the saddle pass was filled with the sounds of steel meeting steel. "We can't afford this," thought Belisarius, as he jerked his lance out of the belly of a Rajput cavalryman. For a moment, he was able to survey the battle scene in reasonable safety. Anastasius and Valentinian were keeping most of the enemy in his vicinity from getting near him. It took less than 5 seconds for Belisarius to make his decision. Enough. It's more ragged than I would have liked, but enough. He shouted new orders to the small unit of courtesans who were trailing him. The horns began blowing the call for retreat. The Thracians obeyed immediately, even though, for the moment, they were winning the battle. Morris had long since purged the ranks of Belisarius's Bucellarii of any arrogant hotheads. If the general says you retreat, then you retreat. Forget about the guy in front of you and the fact that you're beating him into a pulp. The general sees the whole battle. You do what he says, at once. Belisarius himself began moving away from the front line. He swept his eyes back and forth, gauging the progress of his troops. It was uneven. There were still knots of Romans and Rajputs flailing at each other with swords. But most of the cataphracts were falling back well enough. The Rajputs were trying to pursue, of course, but the piled-up bodies of the men and horses driven under in the hammer smash were delaying them badly. Badly enough, Belisarius thought, for most of his men to make their escape. Within seconds, in fact, Belisarius realized that he and his little cluster of soldiers were almost at the very rear of the Roman retreat. A bit isolated, actually. He'd been so preoccupied with watching the rest of the army that he hadn't paid attention to his own situation. Valentinian brought the point home. "We're sticking out like a thumb, General. Everyone's ahead of us. We ought to pick up the pace a little, or—" A swirl of motion caught the corner of Belisarius's eye. He turned his head and saw that a small group of Rajputs had forced their way over the barricade of bodies. The enemy was charging toward them now, with not more than 30 yards to cover. Belisarius didn't even think of fleeing. Against enemies like these, running was sure death. He reined his horse around and set his lance. Alongside him, he sensed Valentinian and Anastasius doing the same. The Rajput in the lead was very tall. As he reared up, holding his spear in the overhead position of stirrupless lancers, he loomed like a giant. Belisarius looked up and up at the man's face. Rajput helmets were visorless beyond a narrow nose guard. The face was Rana Sanga's. Belisarius's own helmet was a German Spangenhelm. The heavy, curving cheek plates covered much of his face, but there was no nose guard. And so in that instant, he knew that Sanga recognized him as well. The friend across the field. But the friend had crossed the field now and was no friend here. Belisarius was about to fight a man who was counted one of the greatest warriors of India. He braced his feet, set the lance, and spurred his charger forward. Valentinian rode alongside, perhaps a pace behind. Anastasius tried to do the same, but was intercepted by two other Rajputs. 2 seconds later, Belisarius learned why Sangha was a legend. Since he first discovered stirrups, Belisarius had never failed to defeat an enemy lancer without them. Until Sangha. The Rajput king avoided the longer and heavier Roman lance by a quick twist in the saddle, and then plunged his own lance downward with all the power of his mighty arm, into the neck of Valentinian's horse. The spear tip penetrated unerringly between two plates in the armor and ruptured arteries. The horse coughed blood and collapsed, spilling Valentinian to the ground. As always in battle, aid was augmenting Belisarius's senses and reflexes. The general's mind seemed to move as quickly as lightning, but it was ice, not fire, which coursed through his nerves now. Sangha's stroke, he realized, had been completely purposeful. The Rajput king had seen Valentinian in action and had obviously made his own estimate of which enemy needed to be taken out first. Which does not, thought Belisarius grimly, speak well for my prospects. The Roman general reined his horse around. In the corner of his eye, he saw that Anastasius was now facing three Rajputs. The giant was hammering one of them down, but he would be no immediate help to Belisarius. Sangha was also wheeling around, ready to charge. He was too close for the heavy lance to be more than a hindrance. Belisarius dropped the weapon and drew his long cavalry saber. He spurred his mount forward. An instant later, his sword stroke was deflected by Sangha's shield. Belisarius barely managed to get his own shield up in time to meet Sangha's counterstroke. The power of that blow was shocking, especially coming from a man riding a horse without stirrups. Unlike Belisarius, Sangha could only grip his horse with his knees. That incredible sword stroke had been delivered with upper body strength alone. Belisarius was a strong man himself, but he knew at once that he was hopelessly outmatched. Fortunately, most very powerful men are slow, and Belisarius hoped. The next stroke came so quickly that even Belisarius's aid-augmented senses could barely react in time to block it. The third blow, Belisarius wasn't even trying to strike back, was aimed at his thigh. Only aid's help allowed Belisarius to interpose his shield quickly enough to keep from having his leg amputated, but his leg went numb. Sangha's sword had driven the shield into his thigh like a sledge, and had also, judging by the sound, cracked the shield itself. The next sword cut broke his shield in half. Only the iron outer rim was still holding it together. Finally, Belisarius swung his own blade. Sangha blocked the cut with his shield and then, with a flashing sweep, hammered the sword right out of Belisarius's hand. In the backstroke, the Rajput king drove Belisarius half out of the saddle. The Roman's shield was practically in tatters now. Never in his life had Belisarius faced such an incredible opponent. He saw another stroke of that terrible sword coming, and he knew he was a dead man. Off balance, with a shredded shield, he had no hope of blocking it. His mind, aid augmented, was still racing. His body couldn't react in time, but everything seemed to move as slowly as blood in winter. He even had time to find it odd that his last thought should be, I can't believe Raghunath Rao faced this man for an entire day. The sword descended, but at the last instant veered aside. Not much, but enough to simply knock Belisarius off his horse instead of cutting him in half. The shield absorbed most of the blow, splintering completely, but Belisarius knew his arm was broken. He was half stunned before he even hit the ground, and that impact dazed him completely. His eyes were still open, but his mind, for a few seconds, was blank. He saw Sangha's horse buckle, saw the lance jutting into the mount's throat, saw Valentinian on foot holding the lance and bringing the beast down, saw Sangha leap free before the horse could pin him, sword still in hand, saw Valentinian's first sword stroke quick as lightning, saw Sangha parry it just in time, saw nothing more but a horse's flank. A huge hand seized him by the collar of his tunic and hauled him up. Hercules, plucking a fruit. He was hanging across the saddle like a sack of flour. His brain began to work again. Anastasius's saddle, he realized. He realized, too, dimly, that he could hear Morris's shouting voice, and the voices of other Thracians. He could hear the sound of pounding hooves and feel the horse beneath him break into a gallop.
Valentinian, he croaked.
Valentinian will have to do for himself, rumbled Anastasius. I'm your bodyguard, not his.
Valentinian, he croaked again.
The giant's sigh was audible even over the sound of thundering horses. Then,
I'm sorry, General. I'll miss the bastard. I surely will, not that I'd ever say it to him.
Then only,
not that I'll ever have the chance. He's on his own now against that demon Sangha and 20,000 of his Rajputs.
Chapter 14. Valentinian didn't have to face 20,000 Rajputs, only their greatest king. By the time the battle between Rana Sangha and Valentinian ended, every one of the Rajputs in Damodara's army was on the crest of the saddle watching, all except the men too badly injured to be moved, and many of those in later years counted that loss worse than their scars and severed limbs. In the annals of Rome, it would be named the Battle of the Pass, but for the Rajputs, it would always be known as the Battle of the Mongoose. In part, the name was given in Belisarius's honor. The Rajputs had won the battle insofar as possession of the field counts as victory, which it does in every land. But even on their day of triumph, they knew that the Roman general had yielded little but the blood-soaked ground itself. A pittance, really, when the disparity in numbers was counted, and the butcher's bill paid. True, they had driven him off and seized the pass and cleared their way to get another range within the Zagros. But there were many more passes to come before they finally broke through to Mesopotamia, and the Roman general had shown them, in rack and ruin, just how steep a price he would charge for that passage. For the most part, however, the name was given in honor of Valentinian. Indians have their own way of looking at animals and incorporating their spirits into legend. Western folk, seeing Valentinian, were often reminded of a weasel. But there are no weasels in India. There are mongoose instead, as quick, as deadly, but admired rather for their cunning than feared for their bloodlust. Like Westerners, Indians are familiar with snakes, but they don't share the Occidental detestation for serpents, rather the opposite. There are few of God's creatures in their eyes as majestic as the king cobra. It was those eyes which watched the battle and gave it the name. Valentinian, much smaller and less powerful than the great king, was the quickest and most agile swordsman any of those Rajputs had ever seen. A battle which most of them expected to last for 3 minutes, if that long, lasted instead for 3 hours. The Roman army watched also from a much greater distance. By the time the battle was well underway, every surviving Roman soldier had forded the river. On the relative safety of the far bank, Belisarius's officers drew the army into formation while the general himself had his broken arm tended to. At first, the Roman troops were tense. They were expecting the enemy to launch a new attack. There was still time, after all. It was no later than mid-afternoon, and this Mulwa army had proven its mettle. Tense, but not worried. The Roman soldiers, in fact, were almost hoping their enemies would try to force their way across the river. They were quite confident of their ability to beat back the assault and with heavy losses. But soon enough it became obvious that the Rajputs had no intention of making any such foolish gesture. They were too battle-wise, first of all. And secondly, they were completely preoccupied with watching the single combat on the crest between Sangha and Valentinian. By the time Belisarius emerged from his tent, his arms splinted and bound to his chest, the Roman troops themselves had settled into the relaxation of watching the match. More accurately, they listened to the news brought by dispatch riders. Only Morris, using Belisarius's telescope, was actually able to see much. When Belisarius came up to Morris, the Kiliarch lowered the telescope.
You heard? He asked.
Belisarius nodded.
Craziest damn thing I've ever seen, muttered Morris.
His attitude didn't surprise Belisarius, nor aid. The custom of single combat between champions is no longer part of Greco-Roman culture. Hasn't been for over a millennium, not since the days of Homer. But it's still a living part of India's traditions, at least among Rajputs. Not even 2 decades of Malwa rule has broken that romantic notion of chivalry. Belisarius's eyes studied the pass above. There seemed to be Rajputs covering every inch of the slopes which provided a view of the battle. Even the Rajput units standing guard assigned to watch for a possible enemy counterattack had their heads turned away from the Roman army. If anything, added Aid, their time in the Malwa yoke is making them treasure this moment even more. There has been nothing like this in years for Rajputana's warriors, just the butchery of Ranipur and Amaravati before that. Morris extended the telescope to its rightful owner. Belisarius shook his head. One of 2 men I treasure is going to die today. I have no desire to watch it. Aid's voice, soft. I am sorry for it too. Morris brought the telescope back to his eye and resumed observing the battle. He had expected Belisarius's response. His offer of the telescope had been more in the way of a formality than anything else. But he was still astonished by the Malwa commander. Craziest thing I've ever seen, he repeated. What the hell is Demodera thinking? He pulled the telescope a few inches from his eye and used it to point at the huge force of Rajputs covering the entire pass. All he has to do is give the order, and Valentinian is a pincushion. You couldn't see him for all the arrows sticking out of his body. Belisarius shook his head. No Rajput would obey that order, and Demodera knows it. If he sent anyone else, the Rajputs would kill them, and Demodera himself, most likely, if they thought he'd given the command. Besides, Belisarius stared across the river and up the slope. He wasn't trying to watch the battle between Sanka and Valentinian. He was simply searching in his mind's eye for Demodera. Aid verbalized his thoughts. A man who rides a tiger long enough begins to think like a tiger himself. This is utter madness, snarled the Malwa spymaster. He glared down at Demodera and pointed to the enemy army across the river half a mile distant. While you waste time in this frivolity, the Romans are making their escape. The Malwa commander, squatting comfortably on a cushion, didn't respond for a few seconds. His eyes remained fixed on the 2 men battling fiercely a few dozen yards away. When he did reply, his tone was mild. It's a moot point, Ishanavarman. Demodera glanced down the slope. Under no circumstances would I order my army to force the river against that opponent. His tone hardened. I certainly have no intention of giving such an order today, not after the losses we've taken from those infernal hand cannons. His eyes moved to the spymaster. They were hard, cold eyes, of whose existence I was not informed by men whose duty it is to know such things. The spymaster didn't flush, but he looked away. Behind him, his 3 top subordinates tried to make themselves as inconspicuous as possible. The best spies in the world, muttered Ishanavarman, cannot discover everything. The spymaster gave Narses a sour look. The eunuch was squatting on his own cushion next to Demodera, at Demodera's left hand, the position allotted by Indian custom to a lord's chief civilian advisor. Did your Roman pet warn you? Demanded Ishanavarman, almost snarling. He has his own spies. Not more than a few, responded Demodera. The Malwa commander was back to watching the battle. Nothing like the horde of spies which Nandalal placed at your disposal. The spymaster gritted his teeth, but said nothing. What was there to say? Nandalal was the chief spymaster for the entire Malwa Empire, and considered Ishanavarman his best agent. Nandalal had assigned him to be the spymaster for Demodera's army for that very reason. By the simple nature of geography, Demodera was operating an independent command. His was the only army not under the immediate and watchful eye of Malwa's rulers. So Nandalal had sent Ishanavarman, with many spies, if not quite a horde, as much to keep an eye on Demodera as his enemies. So what was there to say? Demodera found words. Make yourself useful for a change, Ishana Verman. Interview the surviving Yetai. Find out as much as you can about the hand cannons. Ishana Verman began to say something, but Demotora cut him short. Do it. I am the commander of this army, Spymaster, not you. The Malwa lord lifted his finger in a little gesture at the troops surrounding them. Rajputs, all of them except a few hundred Kshatriyas, those whose proven valor had made them welcome. Most of the Kshatriyas were in the camp, knowing full well the Rajputs wouldn't permit their presence. Ishana Verman scanned the mass of soldiers. There were perhaps 1,000 Yetai there also, but the spymaster didn't fail to notice that the Yetai were scattered through the mass of Rajputs in small groups, individuals, often enough, chatting amiably with their Rajput companions. Rajputs had a certain scorn for Yetai barbarity, but this was a day of manliness, and no one questioned Yetai courage. Do it, repeated Demotora. Again, cold eyes went to the spymaster. Leave now, Ishana Verman. This is not a place for you. The spymaster left then, trailed by his 3 subordinates. Nandalal's agents didn't flee exactly, but neither did they amble. They were not oblivious to other hard, cold eyes upon them. The eyes of thousands of Rajput warriors who had no love for Malwa spies at any time or place, and certainly not here, on this day of glory. When they were gone, Demotora leaned toward Narses. The commander's eyes were still fixed on the combat between Valentinian and Ranasanga, but his gaze seemed a bit unfocused, as if Demotora's thoughts were elsewhere. I trust he no longer has a horde of spies, he murmured. Narses's sneer, as always, was magnificent.
He's got the 3 who came with him, and 2 others. The rest are on my payroll.
Demotora nodded. Tonight, then. I think that would be best.
It'll be perfect, agreed Narses. A pitched battle was fought today. A great victory for Malwa, of course, but not without its cost. The cunning Roman general sent a cavalry troop raiding into our camp. Terrible carnage. Great losses.
Narses crooked his finger. Ajatashatru, squatting 10 feet away, rose and came over.
Tonight, whispered Narses. Do it yourself, if possible.
Ajatashatru did not sneer. He never did. That was one of the reasons, oddly, why Narses had grown so fond of him. But the assassin's thin smile had not a trace of humor in it. Those arrogant snobs haven't used a dagger in years, he said softly. Years spent lounging in Kaushambi, reading reports, while poor downtrodden agents like me were having hair-raising adventures with tired old eunuchs. Narses had a fine grin to match his sneer. It wasn't an expression often seen on his reptilian face, and no more reassuring come to it than a cobra's yawning gape. But the grin stayed on his face for minutes thereafter. He was amused, thinking not of serpents, but of different animals. Tigers, and men who choose to ride them. He glanced at Demotora. The Malwa commander's eyes were riveted on the combat now, and there was nothing unfocused in the gaze.
He might as well have stripes himself, thought Narses.
In the tales of bards and the lays of poets, truth takes on a rosy tinge. More than a tinge, actually. The reality of a single combat between 2 great warriors becomes something purely legendary. There is little place in legends for sweat, even less for thirst and exhaustion, and none at all for urination. But the fact remains that 2 men do not battle each other for hours without rest. Not even if they were fighting half-naked with bare hands, much less encumbered by heavy armor and wielding swords. Single combat between champions, other than a glancing encounter in the midst of a battle, is by nature a formal affair, and, like most formalities, has a practical core at the center of its rituals. After the first 5 minutes, Sangha and Valentinian broke off, gasping for breath. By then, the area was surrounded by Rajputs. Sangha's cavalrymen were still astride their mounts, holding their weapons. One of them, seeing the first open space between the two combatants, began edging his horse toward Valentinian. The man's lance was half raised. Sangha bellowed inarticulate fury. The Rajput shied away. Sangha planted his sword tip in the ground, carefully making sure there were no stones to dull the blade, and leaned upon it. After gasping a few more breaths, he pointed at Valentinian. "Give the man water," he commanded. "Wine, if he prefers." The Rajput king studied his opponent for a few seconds. Valentinian was still breathing deeply and leaning on his own sword, but Sangha saw that he was no longer gasping. "And bring us food and cushions," added Sangha. He smiled quite cheerfully. "I think we're going to need them." For the next few minutes, while Sangha and Valentinian rested, the Rajputs organized the necessities. A dozen Rajputs clustered around Sangha. Four began moving toward Valentinian after lowering their weapons. One of them carried a wine sack, another a skin full of water, the third a rolled-up blanket to serve Valentinian as a cushion whenever he rested, the fourth some dry bread and cheese. Sangha nodded toward them while keeping his eyes on Valentinian. "They will assist you," he called out to the Roman. "Anything you need." Sangha straightened. "You may surrender, of course, at any time." For a moment, Valentinian almost gave his natural response, "Fuck you, asshole," but restrained the impulse. He simply shook his head, a gesture which at the end turned into a little bow. Even Valentinian, hard-bitten and cynical as he was, could sense the gathering glory. In the hours which followed, as a low-born Roman cataphract fought his way into India's legends, the man's mind wondered at his actions. "Why are you doing this, you damn fool?" All his life, Valentinian had been feared by other men. Feared for his astonishing quickness, his reflexes, his uncanny eye. Most of all, for his instant capacity to murder. Precious few men, in truth, can kill at the drop of a hat. Valentinian, since the age of 10, could do it before the hat was touched. And so men feared him, and found in his whipcord shape and narrow face the human image of a vicious predator. "Because I'm tired of being called a weasel," came the soul's reply. The end came suddenly, awkwardly, unexpectedly, almost casually, as it usually does in the real world. The bards and poets, of course, would have centuries to clean it up. Sangha's foot slipped, skidding on a loose pebble. For a moment, catching his balance, his shield swung aside. Valentinian, seeing his opening, swung for the Rajput's exposed leg. No Herculean stroke, just Valentinian's usual economic slice. The quick blade cut deeply into Sangha's thigh. The Rajput fell to one knee, crying out in pain. Pain and despair. His leg was already covered with blood. It wasn't the bright crimson spurting of arterial blood, true, but it was enough. The wound would slay him within half an hour from blood loss alone. Sooner, really. Within minutes, pain and weakness would cripple him enough for his enemy to make the kill. Then, all other men watching or hearing of that battle in years to come would always assume that Valentinian made his only mistake. Yet the truth was quite otherwise. For hours, Valentinian had avoided matching strength with Sangha. He'd countered the king's astonishing power with speed instead. Speed, cunning, and experience. He could have, should have, ended the battle so. Circling the Rajput, probing, slashing, bleeding him further, staying away from that incredible strength until his opponent was so weak that the quick death thrust could be driven home. Killing a king like a wolf brings down a crippled bull, like a weasel kills. Something inside the man, buried deep, rebelled. For the first time since the battle began, for the first time in his life, truth be told, Valentinian swung a heroic blow, a mighty overhand strike at the Rajput's head. Sangha threw up his sword crosswise to block the cut. Valentinian's sword, descending with the power of his own great strength, met a blade held in Rajputana's mightiest hand. The finest steel in the world was made in India. The impact snapped the Roman's sword in half, leaving not more than a 6-inch stub in Valentinian's fist. 6 inches can still be enough in a knife fight. Valentinian never hesitated. Weasel-quick, he flung himself to his own knee and drove the sword stub at Sunga's throat. The Rajput king managed to lower his helmet in time. The blade glanced off the nose guard and ripped a great tear in Sunga's cheek. More blood gushed forth. It wasn't enough. No cry of despair escaped his lips, but Valentinian knew he was finished. Facing each other at close distance, both on their knees, the advantage was now all Sunga's. Sunga was never one for hesitation himself. Instantly, the Rajput king swung a blow. Valentinian interposed his shield. The shield cracked. Another blow. The shield broke. Another blow to the head knocked the Roman's helmet askew. The final blow, again to the helmet, split the segmented steel and sent Valentinian sprawling to the ground. Senseless, at the very least. Probably dead, judging from the blood which began pouring through the sundered pieces of the Spangenhelm. Sanger raised his arm to sever Valentinian's neck, but he stopped the motion even before the sword finished its ascent. He had won a glorious victory this day. He would not stain it with an executioner's stroke. Sanger sagged back on his heels. In a daze, he stared up at the sky. It was sunset, and the mountains were bathed in purple majesty. Around him, vaguely, he heard thunderous cheers coming from thousands of Rajput throats, and seconds later felt hands laying him down and beginning to bind his wounds. A glorious victory. He hadn't felt this clean, this Rajput pure, for many years. Not since the day he fought Raghunath Rao and first entered himself into Indian legend. In the river valley below, the Romans also heard the cheer. The mountains seemed to ring with the sound. Morris lowered the telescope. "That's it," he said softly. Belisarius took a deep breath, then turning to Cootsies, "Send a courier under banner of truce. I want to know if Valentinian's dead so that the priests can do the rites." "And if he's alive?" asked Cootsies. "See if they'll accept the ransom." Belisarius's crooked smile made a brief appearance. "Not that I think I could afford it, even as rich as I am. Not unless Demoter has truly lost his mind." "Not for all the gold in Rome," was Demoter's instant reply. "Do I look like a madman?" When Cootsies brought back the news, Belisarius lowered his head. But his heart, for the first time in hours, soared to the heavens. "He might still die," cautioned Cootsies. "They say he's lost a lot of blood, and his skull's broken." Anastasia snorted. So did Morris. "Not Valentinian," said Belisarius. He lifted his head, smiling as broadly as he ever had in his life. "Not my champion. Not that great roaring lion of a man." The following morning, the Mulwa army began moving along the river, to the northwest, away from the Romans. Belisarius's army, still holding the fords, made no effort to block them. Not a single soldier on either side thought the matter odd. "Let's hear it for maneuvers," said a Rajput to a Yetai. The barbarian nodded quick agreement. "God, I love to march," announced a Greek cataphract. His eyes swept the mountains. "Gives us a chance to admire the scenery, for weeks if we're lucky, maybe even months." "Beats stirring at your own guts," came Assyrian's response. "Even for a minute." Chapter 15. Yemen, Spring 532 AD. "It'll be tonight, for sure," stated Menander. Ashot wobbled his hand back and forth in a gesture which indicated less certainty. "Maybe, maybe not." Menander stood his ground. "It'll be tonight," he repeated confidently. The young cataphract took 2 steps to the entrance of the field quarters and pulled back the flap. The Roman army's camp had been set up 1/2 mile east of a small oasis. Melinda was staring in that direction, but his eyes were on the horizon rather than the oasis itself. A moment later, Euphronius joined him. The young Syrian, he was Menander's age, in his early 20s, took one look at the sky and nodded. Sundown in less than an hour, he said. Moonshine after that until midnight. The Arabs will wait until the moon goes down, then they'll attack. Antonina, seated in a chair near the center of the tent, found herself smiling. As soon as she realized what she was doing, she removed the expression, but not soon enough for it to have escaped Ashot's attention. Ashot grinned at her. She returned the grin with a look of stern admonition, like a prim schoolteacher reproving an older boy in a classroom when he mocked the youngsters, with about the same success. True, Ashot had the grace to press his lips together, but he still looked like the proverbial cat who swallowed a canary. Ashot commanded the 500 cataphracts whom Belisarius had sent along with Antonina on her expedition. Her husband had selected the Armenian officer for the assignment because Belisarius thought Ashot, after Morris, of course, was the best field commander among his Bucellarii. For the most part, Belisarius's decision had been due to Ashot's innate ability, but he had also been influenced by the man's experience. Even though Ashot was only in his mid-30s, the Armenian was a veteran of more battles and campaigns than any other officer in Belisarius' household troops, again, of course, leaving aside Morris. From her own experience over the past year, Antonina had come to understand why Belisarius had counted that so heavily in his decision. She was still herself something of a novice in the art of war. Time and again, Ashot's steadying hand had been there when Antonina's assumptions proved incorrect. The enemy didn't do what you expected them to do? Yeah, well, they usually don't. No problem. We'll deal with it. Euphronius and Menander turned away from the entrance. With the absolute surety possessed only by young men, they made their pronouncements. Tonight, predicted Menander. Right after the moon goes down, decreed Euphronius. The main attack will come from the east, ruled Menander. Euphronius nodded his head. Solon approving a judgment by Hammurabi. Only possible direction. They'll be able to use the setting moon to guide them in the approach, and they won't get tangled up in the oasis. Antonina squared her shoulders. Very well, then. See to the preparations. The two young officers swept out of the tent, brushing aside the flap as if they were the trade winds. When they were gone, Antonina eyed Ashot. The Armenian's grin was back in full force. All right, she growled. Now tell me what you think. Still grinning, the Armenian shrugged. I don't know. And for that matter, I don't care. The attack might come tonight, although I'm skeptical, so we need to be prepared anyway. It'll be good drill, if nothing else. Ashot pulled up a chair and lounged in it. His grin faded into a smile of approval. I like cocky young officers, he said. As long as they're men of substance, which those two certainly are. He shrugged again. They'll get the silly crap knocked out of them soon enough. In the meantime, I can count on them to stand straight in the storm. Whenever it comes, from whatever direction. Antonina lifted a cup from the table next to her chair and took a sip. The vessel was filled with water from the nearby oasis, flavored with just a dash of wine. Why don't you think it'll be tonight? She asked. Ashot stroked his cheek, running fingers through his stiff and bristly beard. It just doesn't seem likely to me, that's all. We'll be facing Bedouin nomads. They're quite capable of moving fast once they've made their decision. Fast enough, even through the desert, that they could be in position by tonight. He leaned forward, planting elbows on knees. But I know that breed. I can almost guarantee that they'll spend 2 or 3 days quarreling and bickering before they decide what to do. He chuckled. That's the whole point of this exercise. That's why we landed north of Sana instead of right at the coast with Aeon and his Sarawit. Antonina nodded. The tactics of this campaign had been primarily worked out by Ashot and Wasi. Antonina and Aeon, of course, had approved the plan, but neither had felt themselves qualified to develop in the first place. And if they had, she knew they wouldn't have thought to come up with this plan. Ashot and Wasi, veterans of campaigns and not just battles, had immediately seen the weakness in the traitor Abraha's strategic position. His problem was political more than purely military. Abraha was holding Yemen with only two rebel regiments from the Ethiopian army. Those two regiments, the Metin and the Falha, were forted up in the provincial capital of Sana'a. The third regiment, stationed in Arabia, the Holland at Marib, was still maintaining neutrality in the civil war. The bulk of Abraha's forces, therefore, well over three-fourths of them, consisted of Arab irregulars. Warriors from the various Bedouin tribes in southern Arabia under the shaky command of an unstable cluster of war chiefs. As individuals, the Arab nomads were ferocious fighters, but their discipline was almost non-existent, and their concept of war was essentially that of brigands and pirates. They had flocked to Abraha's banner not because they cared which faction of Aksum ruled southern Arabia, but because they saw a chance for loot. So Antonina was offering them a juicy plum. Her small army of Romans, detached and isolated from the main body of Ethiopian Sarwan, who had landed on the coast near Sana'a. Rome was the land of wealth in that part of the world. What few gold coins the Arabs possessed were solidi minted in Constantinople. The streets of the fabled city, capital of the Roman Empire, were reputed among those tribesmen to be paved with gold. There were a few skeptics in their midst, of course, who thought the tales unlikely. Silver, certainly, but not gold. Now, this day, ready to be plucked, was a force of rich Romans not more than 2,000 strong. Less than that, really, in the eyes of the Bedouin. At least 500 of those Romans were women. And that, of course, was another inducement to attack. The tribesmen would capture concubines along with treasure. Roman women to boot, who were reputed to be the most beautiful women in the world. Again, of course, there were skeptics. That they were all women themselves, driven by spite and jealousy. It was a cunning plan. Even if Abraha tried to restrain them, his Arab irregulars would ignore his orders. But Ashotenwasi thought that Abraha, in all likelihood, would not object. From a purely military standpoint, attacking the Romans would seem to be a good move. By approaching Sana'a from the north in a separate column, the Romans were isolated from the Aksumite army under Aeon. Abraha would see the chance to defeat his enemy in detail. A cunning plan, and risky. There were at least 5,000 Bedouin under Abraha's banner. They would outnumber the Roman forces by a factor of almost 3-1. Antonina's eyes drifted to a corner of the tent. There, resting on a small table, was her own hand cannon. Much as she detested the thing, the sight of the weapon helped to restore her confidence. The hand cannon was smaller than the heavy smoothbores carried by her cohort, and much more finely crafted. John of Rhodes had made it for her personally. It was the prototype of a line of weapons he planned to develop for cavalrymen. He called it a pistol. "An over and under double-barreled caplock, to be precise," he told her when he handed her the weapon a week before her departure from Alexandria. "It's the first gun made using the new percussion caps. Beautiful piece, isn't it?" Antonina, handling the device, had privately thought the term beautiful was absurd. To her, the grotesque-looking weapon was ugly, awkward, and god-awful heavy. Her small hand could barely hold the grip. "No, no, Antonina," John exclaimed. "You've got to hold it with both hands. Here, put your left hand under the stock. That's why the wood's there." His expression shaded from pride to half-apology. "It's not really a true handgun yet, except for a big man, but it's the best I could come up with this soon." Despite her private reservations, Antonina had thanked John for the gift, quite profusely at the time he gave it to her. 2 days later, after spending several hours on the practice range, John had been adamant on the point. Her thanks were less heartfelt. She had no doubt the damn thing would do its lethal duty if and when the time came, but her hands ached and her butt was bruised from the time she'd been knocked off her feet by the recoil. She darkly suspected, moreover, damn what the doctor said, that at least one of her shoulders was dislocated, permanently from the feel of it. Ashot's eyes followed hers. "Ugly damn thing," he grunted. "Glad I don't have to shoot a hand cannon. Even that one, much less the bone breakers the cohort uses." For all the sourness of the words, however, his expression was cheerful enough. He leaned back in his chair and planted his hands on his hips. "Relax, Antonina, the plan'll work. It looks a lot riskier than it really is, unless we screw up." Antonina blew out her cheeks. You're that confident in the hand cannons? She asked. Ashot snorted. Antonina, I don't have confidence in any weapons. Weapons are just tools. I don't care how newfangled and fancy they are. No better than the men who use them. He waved his hand. I do have confidence in those Syrian boys out there, and their wives. But most of all, I've got confidence in the general. The general, to Ashot, meant Belisarius. Like most of the Bucellarii, it was a title which Ashot bestowed on no one else. So Antonina was surprised when Ashot added, both generals. She gazed at him quizzically. Ashot chuckled. Didn't your husband ever mention him to you? I'm sure he must have. Antonina understood the reference then. Belisarius had done much more than mention that other general to her, in point of fact. In the weeks leading up to his departure for Persia the year before, Belisarius had spent half his time preparing his wife for her own expedition. He had drilled her for hours, day after day, in that other general's tactics. He'd even insisted, the only time he ever did so, that she take aid in her hand and enter the crystal's world of visions. She almost shuddered, remembering those scenes of ghastly slaughter. But she took heart as well, remembering the Battle of Waterloo, where the French cavalry broke again and again against Wellington's infantry at the ridge of La Haye Sainte. Maybe tonight, she heard Ashot murmur, and maybe not. Doesn't matter. We'll break the bastards whenever they come. He barked a harsh laugh. The only thing I know for sure is this, Antonina. A month from now, those Bedouin hotheads will be sulking in their tents, calling you the Iron Dyke. Chapter 16. The attack came two nights later, long before the moon went down, and from the south. Menander and Euphronius were both exceedingly disgruntled. The tactics of their enemies made no sense at all. They got over it quickly enough. Very quickly. Whatever the Arabs lacked in the way of tactical acumen, they made up for in other ways. Ashot wasn't surprised, neither by the Arabs' tactics nor by the vigor of their attack. The timing was about what he had guessed, so far as the day was concerned. He had not really expected Bedouin irregulars to be patient enough to wait until midnight. South was the direction from which they had come, and they had the advantage of moonlight to guide them. True, the same moonlight made them easier targets, but the desert warriors sneered at such unmanly concerns. There was a hill to the south, moreover, almost next to the Roman camp. The hill would disguise the Arabs' approach and give them the advantage of charging downhill. None of it, as Ashot had foreseen, made any difference. The Theodoran cohort was prepared, as they had been, for 3 days. As soon as the sun went down, the troops were on full alert. The matchlocks were loaded, and the matches themselves were lit. The musketeers buckled on their short swords. The wives laid out the grenades, cut the fuses, prepared the cartridges. Sharpened stakes were set in the ground at 18-inch intervals, making for additional protection for the musketeers. The Thracian cataphracts, dismounted, took up their pikes. The smell of smoldering slow match blew across the camp on the ceaseless breeze. The cataphracts and the cohort waited. Ashot waited. Menander and Euphronius polished their certainties. Antonina mouthed a silent prayer for the soul of a general she had never met and never would, wherever that soul might be. 2 hours after sundown, the attack started. With a sudden whoop, several thousand Arabs on camelback surged over the hilltop and began charging down onto the camp. Most of them were holding swords, but many brandished torches. What the hell? Demanded Menander. What's wrong with those stupid, began Euphronius. But the young commander of the cohort broke off. He had immediate duties to attend to. Sling staffs, he shouted. To the south, as soon as the enemy's in range. He raced off, seeing to the disposition of the musketeers. Menander stayed behind, standing next to Antonina and Ashot. He was in direct charge of the cataphract pikemen, but he really had nothing to do. The cataphracts, veterans all, were no more surprised by the illogic of the enemy's attack than Ashot. And unlike the musketeers, they didn't have cumbersome supplies and equipment to move around. The units, without waiting for orders, simply shifted their positions slightly. They didn't have far to go. Ashot had set the camp in such a way that the Roman troops formed a tightly packed square. The musketeers formed the front line on all four sides, protected by the palisade of sharpened stakes. The pikemen took position just a few yards behind, ready to form an additional bulwark where needed. The grenadiers, along with the 100 cataphracts whom Ashot was keeping as a mounted reserve, were positioned in the center of the camp. Range for grenadiers wielding sling staffs meant 150 yards. By the time the first wave of Arabs reached that distance, the wives had cut and lit the fuses. The grenades were sent on their way. Ashot mounted up. He managed the task unassisted and with relative ease. Like the rest of the cataphracts, he was wearing half armor instead of full gear. He had felt that would be enough against lightly armed irregulars. Mobility would be more important than protection and weight of charge in this battle. Ashot wasn't planning any thunderous sallies in any case. His relative handful of cavalrymen would be swallowed up in a sea of swirling Bedouin if they ever left the safety of the camp. Their role was to provide a sharp, quick counterpunch wherever the enemy might threaten to break through the front lines. Menander and Euphronius, of course, had argued with him. "Can't destroy an enemy without cavalry pursuit," Menander had sagely pointed out. Euphronius nodded firm agreement. "Don't need to," had been Ashot's sanguine reply. "We're not facing disciplined regulars who'll regroup after a defeat. The Bedouin haven't got any staying power. They'll attack like maniacs, but if they bounce off, good and bloodied, they'll decide the whole business isn't favored by the gods. They'll melt into the desert and go back to tending their flocks. That's good enough for our purposes. Abraham won't have them at his side when Aeon and Wasi storm into Sana." Menander and Euphronius, of course, hadn't been convinced, but the youngsters had satisfied themselves in the days thereafter with lengthy exchanges on the subject of senility. Antonina did less than anyone waiting for the charge. She simply followed Ashot's advice, say better instructions, and stood firmly in her place, right at the center of the camp where everyone could see and hear her. "Your job," Ashot had explained cheerfully, "is simply to give the troops confidence. That's it, Antonina. Just stand there looking as resolute as Athena and shout encouragement. And make sure you wear that obscene breastplate." Antonina donned the cuirass with the help of her maid Coutina. Looking down at her immense brass mammary, she had her usual reaction. Ashot's good cheer faded. "And try not to giggle," he grumbled. "That looks bad in a commander during desperate battle." Antonina giggled. Now, as she waited for the charge, Antonina had no trouble restraining her giggle. She maintained her outward composure, but she was quite scared. Terrified, if truth be told. Ashot could make his veteran pronouncements, and her young officers could decree the certain future. But all Antonina could see, staring at the horde of shrieking nomads coming down the hill like an irresistible force of nature, was a wave of rape and murder. Cursing at the weight of her awkward firearm, she shifted the strap which held the thing over her shoulder. Her hand groped for the hilt of her sword. Once her fingers curled round the plain wood of the blade's utilitarian handle, she felt her confidence return. She had used that cleaver before, and used it successfully, to defend herself against rape and murder when Malwa-paid thugs attacked her in Constantinople. Morris had purchased the cleaver afterward and given it to her for her personal weapon in the battle at the stadium. "Ask any veteran, Antonina," he told her at the time. "They'll all tell you there's nothing as important in a battle as having a trusty, tested blade." The cleaver brought confidence, and so even more did Ashot's whispered words. "It's just another knife fight in a kitchen, Antonina, like you've done before." The grenades began landing among the Arabs. Few of them missed. The Syrian slingers were combat veterans themselves now. The confidence which that gave them, added to their own skill, made for a murderous volley. As before, against cavalry, the main effect of the exploding bombs was moral. Not many of the Arabs themselves were killed, or even seriously injured by the crude devices. Most of the casualties were sustained by their mounts, and even the camels didn't suffer greatly. The year before, when used against Ambrose's rebel cataphracts on the paved streets of Alexandria, shrapnel from exploding grenades had wreaked havoc on the unarmored legs of their horses. But here, on desert sand, there were no ricochets to multiply the damage. The camels didn't suffer greatly from physical damage, that is, but the beasts were completely unaccustomed to artillery fire and immediately began to panic. The sound and fury of the explosions caused most of that terror, but even the sputtering flare of a burning fuse caused camels to stumble and shy away. Camels are large animals, heavier than horses. Once started on a charge down a hill, they were impossible to stop. But the charge, as hundreds of camels either collapsed from wounds or simply stumbled from fear, turned into something more in the nature of an avalanche. An avalanche is a fearsome thing, true, but it has no brains at all. By the time thousands of Bedouin piled up at the foot of the hill, not 50 yards from the Roman front lines, they had about as much coordination and conscious purpose as a snowdrift blown by the wind. Euphronius gave the order.
Level!
Antonina held her breath.
Fire!
50 yards was within range of the smoothbore arquebuses. Some of the bullets went wide, and many simply buried themselves in the sand. But of the hundreds of rounds fired in that first volley, almost a fourth found a human target. It mattered hardly at all whether the bullet struck a head, a torso, or a limb. Round shot loses muzzle velocity quickly, but within 50 yards the loss wasn't enough to offset the weight of the 80-caliber lead dropshot. The heavy projectiles at that range caused terrible wounds and struck with incredible force. Arms were blown off, not simply wounded. Thigh bones were pulverized. Men died from shock alone. The first line of musketeers stepped back, replaced by the second. Antonina expected Euphronius to give the order to fire immediately, but the Syrian waited for the dense cloud of gun smoke to clear away. She began dancing impatiently until she realized what she was doing and forced herself to stand still. Restraint was difficult, even though Antonina understood Euphronius's inaction. It was impossible to see more than a few yards from the front line, and would have been even in broad daylight. Even the crest of the hill was obscured by the gun smoke. Until the smoke cleared, the musketeers would be guessing at their target. A few gaps began appearing in the clouds. Enough, apparently. Euphronius gave the order, and the arquebuses roared again. The second line stepped back, and the third line came forward. By now, Antonina saw the first line was already reloaded and ready to fire again. She felt a certain female smugness. Her troops could manage a much better rate of fire, she knew, than those of her husband. Despite the fact that they were using the same type of firearms, her troops had wives standing with the men. The Theodoran cohort carried twice as many hand cannons as they